Don't let your final farewell stir up family feuds. Welcome to Before You Go, a podcast brought to you by Texas Estate, Trust, and Guardianship Attorneys, Stacy Kelly and Keith Morris. Preserve your hard-earned legacy. Be in the know.
Hi, this is Keith Morris, and we are here today for Before You Go, Episode 6. And today we're going to be talking about will contests. And as always, my faithful partner, Stacy Kelly, is with me, and we have our special guest today, Rudy Culp. And we're going to just discuss will contests, how you file them, what the reasons are, some of the other issues that are associated, and also things to consider as far as the emotional toll that it takes. And we're going to throw in some interesting anecdotes and cases that we've dealt with. But I'm going to turn it over to Rudy and let him introduce himself and talk about what he's done and how long and all those good things.
My name is Rudy Culp. I've been practicing in probate for almost 20 years, I guess now. Graduated U of H Law School in 2004. Is that right? Yeah.
Yes, because you graduated with David.
I've been with the law firm I'm with now as an associate and now as a partner. It's a law firm of Horrigan, Gores, Edwards, and Culp. We are in Houston. Our primary practice is in Harris County, but we practice in the surrounding areas as well as around the state, almost exclusively probate fiduciary litigation.
And Rudy and I have known each other for a very long time. He actually went to law school with my brother, and they both graduated at the same time. And actually, they also have the same birthday, which is interesting, too. So, all right, that's how I never forget to remind
him.
That's right. I remember every year to tell him happy birthday because it's the day after mine and the same day as David's. So will contests, people call all the time, your office, our office, and I need to contest this will because I don't like what happened. And I always joke that will contests sort of fit into three categories. One is I don't like my stepmommy. Two is my parents treated my sibling better than me. Or three, and one that's kind of become more prevalent now, which is for some reason that I don't understand, my dad or mom left everything to the next door neighbor or the housekeeper or whatever. I guess, Stacy, you already talked about some of the cases that you've had where people have called, and tell us about why and how and what circumstances you file a will contest.
First of all, what is a will contest? And that's when someone has taken what purports to be someone else's last will and has filed it in the proper court to have that will probated as the person's last will. And then someone else comes along who doesn't like what's in the will, just like Keith mentioned, thinks it's unfair to them, thinks it should have been left more left to them or something left to them. And so when they come to us, we have to sit down with them and decide what are the legal grounds for contesting this will. You can't just go into court and say, hey, I don't like it, and therefore I'm contesting it. You have to have a reason. That basically is four different reasons. The first is that perhaps the person lacked the testamentary capacity to execute a will. And what that means is basically, did they have the mental ability to understand and make necessary decisions regarding the will at the time of execution? In Texas, it's four-prong test, if you will. It's, does the person understand the nature and extent of their property, have a good grasp of that? Do they know who the natural objects of their property would be? So if I have children, naturally I would want to leave them to my children or my husband. And as Keith mentioned, somebody's left it all to their caretaker and cut out their whole family. And then they also need to understand the disposition, they're making the will. What are they doing? They understand that they're making a will. And to be able to connect all of those things together at the moment you're drafting or executing the will. So you could have had a stroke or something and not had testamentary capacity during that time, but you could have it now and be doing the will. So you're really looking at that point in time when someone executed the will. I have an interesting case right now, which is going to be mostly undue influence. That's another way to contest a will. And in Texas, that's the existence and exertion of an influence that effectively overpowers the mind of the person doing the will at the time of the execution. And and that the execution would not have happened but for this undue influence. I've got a situation where strange will left some, probably 30 different people left something in this will. And luckily we have an audio tape that four or five of these people, 2 hour long audio tape of them recording the testator. But in it, they're saying, now you want to leave this to so-and-so, right? And that's not fair. You should leave this to them. I mean, that is the epitome of undue influence. The gentleman was very sick on his deathbed, very susceptible to the undue influence. That's going to be a fun case to try.
Undue influence. We have a bright line test for lack of testament capacity. I mean, for the most part, right? But for undue influence, it's a little
bright
bit
line.
Well, brighter line than undue influence. I mean, undue influence can be, it's sort of a very touchy-feely standard. I mean, you can have one witness that overpowers 15 of their witnesses or whatever. So talk a little bit about that as far as when you're trying to prove that case, the difficulties associated with the undue influence.
And I think you got to kind of what Kepler Stacy talked about is she's talking about a case where undue influence may be the prime issue. But you got to remember, she's talking about someone who's on his deathbed, right? So I think you always look at these kind of go hand in hand to me. It's a sliding scale. It's why you almost always claim both. So lack of capacity, are you going to be able to prove that they didn't have the capacity, the testamentary capacity? Maybe. But if you don't, even if that capacity is waned, if this is someone older, I think their susceptibility as they age, and even if they have capacity, they become more susceptible to that undue influence. So I think that's a big point in any undue influence claim is maybe not lack of capacity, but the declining capacity and the age. I think undue influence is also who's around them. Caretakers, are these provisions in the will, are they a change from what they were before? Are they an unnatural disposition? Is there someone that's been around them? And caretaker is a great case, right? Because no jury is going to look at a caretaker and think, oh, well, this is the person. But we see a lot with family. You know, there'll be an isolation where they isolate this individual. They get a new will done, or maybe they never had a will. And now we suddenly have a will that leaves all or most of the estate to the child who was taking care of them, which gives that child an interesting position to take is, well, yeah, they changed their will because I was doing everything for them. But that's also the fact that they're there and isolating them gives them also a fact in our favor that says, okay, they have unduly influenced. They had the opportunity. They had the way. So I think with undue influence, it is tough because you very rarely have what Stacy has in this case where you have a recording where the person's saying, don't you think you should do this? Isn't this what you want to do? I mean, that's almost as close as you get to a slam dunk on undue influence because I'll tell you, they're usually very tough because it's almost always based on circumstantial evidence around it. Like we said, isolation, who was there? What are the changes? What does it look like before? Because there's not going to be a piece of paper that shows generally undue influence. And so it's a tougher case, certainly a much easier case to prove lack of capacity if you have evidence of it, because you usually have medical. But even in that, with the isolation, sometimes you'll see there won't be an evaluation for a few years around this new will. And they were fine 2 years ago. Then you have testimony about people, what they saw, the general people who were around them. But isolation causes problems with that too. And so I think circumstantial evidence applies there as well.
Yeah, and there used to be, the case law used to say that undue influence and lack of capacity were mutually exclusive, that it was either one or the other. But that standard has changed over time, basically in the way that you said it, which was, okay, well, maybe it's not bright line lack of capacity, but it's the declining capacity that makes them more susceptible to the influence.
Exactly. Yeah. I think no matter what you're working both of those issues up in any kind of will contest surrounding those kind of facts.
And in our case, we had neighbors and an evil stepdaughter who were keeping the few family members away who were out of town asking, you know, do we need to come down and help? Oh, no, everything's fine. So, yeah, they were isolating him. And then he did the will a week before he died. Again, that was also done in the hospital, which is not that that's necessarily indicative of anything.
Was it, and probably not done by an attorney?
No.
Probably printed off the internet.
No, it was done by an attorney, which is something that I'll have to overcome, because obviously the attorney is going to testify that, of course, they had capacity. I would not have done it if they didn't have capacity. But the good thing about undue influence is the attorney, the drafting attorney, usually is not a witness of the undue influence. They don't see that. And so when they come in and say, is this what you want? And the person says, yes, but they don't know everything that's led up to this is what I
right.
want. Yeah.
It's highly likely that he got his information from someone other than the decedent as well.
I mean, that's a big thing. Is we had a case not too long ago where the lawyer who referred the case to me was a friend of mine, and he's the one that drafted the will. And he's like, man, every lawyer's got their one case. He was like, I wasn't taking direction from the testator. I was taking it from the son because I thought that was okay. And, you know, the daughter and the son were both getting something. The son was getting more. I really didn't know what the value of the assets were. And like, basically, the will left a couple of pieces of property to the son, a couple pieces of property to the daughter. But the property that went to the son was 5-10 times more valuable than what went to the daughter. And he didn't know that. But again, he didn't take the direction from the testator. He took it from the son. And so that happens. That's always a problem. Thankfully, it got settled. But
and I feel like as litigators, we should probably do a podcast of how to avoid a will contest. I know there's been plenty of talks about that. But I mean, that's a huge deal, I think, for estate planners. Is we've both come across cases where the estate planners, like, they just didn't do the right thing, whether or not there's a will contest, but they created a contest, whether that's a nuisance contest or what the objective is. But there were so many things that they could have done differently to avoid it, whether they did anything wrong or not, no actionable thing wrong. But there were so many things they could have done to avoid these issues.
Yeah. So now you have obligated yourself to next month, part two, which is how to avoid a will contest. I mean, we have a lot of estate planners in our firm, and so we're constantly, at least once or twice a year, having an internal meeting with everybody saying, okay, so here are all the things that, you know, you shouldn't do, or if you have any questions about it, you need to bring a litigator in to like let them sort of analyze everything, and that happens. But yeah,
And I think that's a testament to hiring estate planners who either, one, have access to them, or educated themselves on the litigation side of it. Because I mean, I've dealt with some very intelligent estate planners who have made some really dumb mistakes just because they're trying to figure things out. I mean, I had one just recently where we were trying to figure out how to fix this. He was trying to figure out how to fix this estate planning, and he did it. He was so excited. He'd figured it out. He did these changes. Then he did wills for mom, and then he did changes the trust for the trustee. And then he comes out and says, I didn't even represent mom. Whoa, we did a will for mom, didn't represent her, did the changes that he was requested to do by the trustee that benefited the trustee. That's a huge problem. And he didn't do it on purpose. He thought he was benefiting everybody. He thought he was doing the right thing.
The other two grounds for a will contest would be fraud or forgery. Sometimes people just forge someone's signature. We had that a long time ago with one of the first will contests I ever did was for a son of the people that own Bluebell ice cream. And the will was a forgery. It ended up being a forgery at the end of the day. So that's one. And the last one is improper execution. And that just means, you know, in Texas, you have to be 18 years old. I'm not talking about holographic wills here, and it needs to be signed and witnessed. So if you don't have it signed by the testator, or you don't have the proper witnesses, then that's another way to challenge the will.
And the witnesses are not all present at the same time.
Right. And they have to be there, and they have to see the decedent sign it, and it has to be one event, all of them together. So that's drilling down and talking to your potential client and finding out exactly what did happen at the signing.
I think one of the greatest improper execution cases that Jason and I had was, we had a will and the two witnesses were in cahoots with the beneficiaries who were not family members. And there was something strange about the way that everybody talked about the will execution and didn't match. So what we figured out through obtaining records, cell phone records, because if you don't know, If you're on your cell phone and you're in Corpus Christi, and then when you talk on the cell phone, it bounces off a tower in Corpus Christi. It doesn't bounce off a tower in Houston, right? So we were able to get the cell phone records. And apparently at the time that allegedly the witnesses signed the will, everybody had already testified to when they signed the will. The testator was in Splendora and the witnesses were in Corpus. And so since we have not yet all figured out how to do the old Star Trek, you know, the thing where you get to time warp yourself or whatever, it was impossible. So we finally went back and redeposed them and asked them and figured out that it was not executed when they said that it was executed. So, you know, that's fun.
And Keith, isn't there, I do think there is a law that allows the testator to affirm that that's his signature as long as it's in front of the witnesses. Even if he had signed previously, he had Correct. To be there and affirm, hey, I did sign this. This is my signature.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
One of the things I've noted with forgery is interesting lately is the change in the world today. So you don't have that many exemplars of people's signatures. People don't sign a million checks. They don't sign all these contracts. I mean, most of my contracts I'm signing now for things are online, and it's a pretend handwritten signature. And the same with checks. I can't remember maybe a few checks in the last year, but rarely do I write a check. I either have it sent from the bank directly to pay it, or I pay with a card. So I think it's getting harder and harder to get the evidence you need. This came up recently. It's a handwritten will. We had exemplars of the signature, but to get even more difficult is a handwritten will, to get examples of someone's signature. People don't write letters and cards and the stuff that we 10, 15 years ago that we would get tons of. It's not there. And then you have the fact that even these handwriting experts are like, it needs to be within the couple years of when the signature was done. You can't give me 20-year-old documents because that's not close enough to the time. Maybe they can get something from it, but there's a difficulty in that. So handwritten wills, proving that is or is not someone's handwriting is really difficult. Signature may be a little easier, but I think we're going to see that get harder and harder too because the necessity to sign things anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of almost feel like at this point that since we're getting to that point, they need to go ahead and find some way to allow wills to be done electronically. And as part of that process, a program to be used that allows for verification so that could potentially completely and totally wipe out that issue about forgery. And obviously, there's still going to be ways. Anytime there's something where there's a will, there's a way, someone can do it. But
it's just going to create another...
It'll create another something, you know, then it'll be digital forgery or digital fraud, whatever it is. But yeah, I mean, we've had the same problem in cases where we needed to have handwriting. It's like, well, we need something. And well, I don't have anything. Or someone has gone into the house and taken everything out and destroyed it. So there's no way to get any handwritten yep. anything from anybody. So yeah.
The idea that we have allowed people to tell, oh, I've seen him sign, that's his signature. I mean, I know we're pretty open with allowing that, but the number of people in someone's life that would actually have seen them sign and be able to recognize that signature is so small and getting smaller. I can foresee this being a lot more difficult as we go forward.
Yeah, for sure.
Proving one way or the other. And I think the burden is going to be on the applicant, right? They have to prove that that's the signature. Undue influence may be on us, but the applicant, it may have some trouble in the future. And I think now that opens the door for nuisance lawsuits, right? If they can't prove that's his signature, what do you do?
Yeah. So, Stacy, there are timing, filing requirements, issues with standing and things like that. Talk about that in Texas, how we make sure that it's filed timely, that, you know, who has the ability to file a will contest and things of that nature.
Okay. Basically, a will has to be offered for probate within 4 years of the death of the testator. Exceptions to that, but basically within 4 years. You have 2 years. Once the will is admitted to probate, you have 2 years to file a will contest after that. You can obviously, we've recently filed one where someone filed a will for probate and we were able to contest the will before the will was actually admitted to probate. And what that does is it switches the burden on who has to prove what and the timing of that. The people that can file a will contest are anyone that's named in the will and the natural heirs. So if everything was left to one child and there's three children, the other two children would be the natural heirs if there were not a will. And so they have the standing, if you will, to contest the will.
I think standing is I've never had standing come up in a will contest, because generally the people contesting the will clearly have standing, right? Just the people you kind of said, which was the heirs, or they're named in some will, some document, or claim to be named. But if you look at the law, it is so broad who has standing. I think a creditor has standing. I think if you look, there's cases that say a beneficiary of a trust that receives assets from this estate has standing. A beneficiary of another estate that may receive assets from this estate would have standing. Not just the executor, anyone who actually ultimately may have a receive something from that estate. So it is really wide open. I actually had a case, and it was a will contest. We didn't file the will contest. We got it late. It was a mess, but it's an interesting fact, and it does get into standing. We represented the daughter. The decedent had married his biological niece, his sister's daughter. And so the will contest was contesting the will. He was incapacitated. We're pretty sure about that. But the will also named her as executor and as sole beneficiary, basically. And so we decided, when we got it, we said, well, that marriage is void. So we filed a summary judgment and said, look, it's void. They can't be married under Texas law. Therefore, those provisions in the will should be read as if she predeceased, and therefore she's out. Court agreed. We appeal it. Goes to the appellate court, even goes up to the Supreme Court. They denied. They didn't look at it. But the appellate court said, look, one of the issues was whether or not our client had standing to contest that void marriage, because under the will, she was not a beneficiary, even if we were to win. Her being buried or not had no standing as to whether we could test it. And so the court ultimately said, look, there's a provision in the will that says if all of these other provisions fail, then it goes by intestacy. So we had standing by that. But we argued a case, and there's cases that talk about this. It's a Haas case. And what it said is, in that case, it said it was a personal injury lawsuit where a common law spouse came in and said, hey, I filed a claim. And so that defendant filed a separate lawsuit to declare that that marriage was void. And of course, there were standing issues. Like, it didn't, their liability for the damage had nothing to do with whether this marriage was void or not. So the wife was like, you have no standing. Well, the court said, look, if that ultimately has any effect on this other lawsuit, then you have standing to have that determined. And so that was our biggest argument on appeal. They just didn't get to it because they had the provision was, look, it's an ultimately affects it. So to me, standing is so wide open. There are so many ways to get into it. That is the only case I have ever had a will contest where it ever became an issue, because I think almost anybody who can make a claim has standing.
Yeah. And I've had some where I've tried to motion and limiting people out before for standing, and won a couple times and lost a couple times, but yeah.
Well, if you get them limited out, they definitely have no interest in that estate.
That was a common law wife as well.
Yeah.
That case.
So let's talk about the process of getting a will contest filed. So someone comes to the office, Stacey, you mentioned, and they don't like what happened, or they think there's something fishy going on. How does that work? And what is the process to get that filed?
Well, I think you first meet with a probate attorney and give them the facts of the case, and they can advise you that they think they have a good faith basis on challenging the will. You would then file a contest contesting the will, and you have to file where they filed the will for probate. You have to file in that same court. Some things you could look at: if it's a smaller county, you might be able to get a statutory probate judge assigned, but you need to do that and ask for that when you file the will contest. So
in the same document.
Yes. And so you need to be speaking to an attorney that knows what they're doing on this, because you can waive that really quick, and you can be in a small county with a judge that does traffic tickets and foreclosures and evictions, and then they're also going to dabble now in this pretty serious probate action.
And you got to remember, when you get a statutory probate judge, which is for us, that's absolutely what we want. But that county has to pay that judge. So there is no chance, if they have a choice of whether sending us to district court or sending us to a statutory probate judge, that they will ever choose that. So you're right. You got to get that in simultaneously with your will contest.
I mean, it needs to be in the pleading. We started doing that. And I think, Stacy, it was a case that you and Tammy had, right? Where in one of the counties where it was separate motions, but the will contest and the motion for statutory probate judge were separate documents. And the clerk's office, and they were mailed in the same envelope, but the clerk's office had the audacity to say, oh, we got one, but not the other. So we went ahead and moved to district court. So they did the old county clerk shuffle on you. And I think that was you and Tammy, right?
Yeah, we've had one of those. So learned that lesson very early on and very quickly, that same document, don't ever put them in two documents, even if you're filing them at the exact same time.
Yeah.
And I think that that goes to your point too. It's if you're considering a will contest, you need to find an attorney who specializes in this area of the law and who practices in that county. Because I think not only is it important to have someone who knows the law, which you two clearly do, but also someone who is familiar with the court, the clerks, who knows who to call at the court, can get things done. That makes a huge difference, not only in how well it goes, but minimizing the cost as much as possible. We've all been involved in cases with an attorney on the other side that doesn't know what he's doing, where you end up spending thousands of dollars just dealing with someone who doesn't understand how to practice in probate.
Yeah, we have a case right now, the one where I was taking all the depositions last week, and it fits into one of the three that we talked about at the beginning, which is that in this case, our client is the non-family member who was left everything. But whereas normally that would cause me concern, that there's evidence and testimony from witnesses that justify the reason that the mom made that decision and had been estranged from her daughters for 10 years before her death. And there are there's one prior will that also cuts the daughter out. So, and this is another interesting thing, just because someone works at a big firm, or just because they have 35 years of experience as an awesome litigator and this, that, or the other, if they don't practice specifically in this area, that doesn't really mean anything. You can't just go, I mean, there are probably a handful of lawyers, people I could think of, you know, Rusty Harden, right? I mean, he's probably someone that doesn't matter what kind of case it is, he can figure it out and do what he's supposed to do. But there are not that many of those people around. So just because someone works at a big firm and knows what they're doing in other areas doesn't mean that they know what they're doing here. And we've got a case now where this lawyer just thinks that they're going to win because they represent the daughters and is not taking into account anything that happened between the estrangement incident and the will number one, which also cuts his clients out. And I sat there through my client's deposition, was listening to the questions that were being asked. And I was like, man, you're just not barking up the right tree here. You don't know what you need to prove. I'm not saying anything to be disparaging. What I'm actually doing is saying that the three people, at least the other two that are on this podcast, know what they're doing. I'm not going to say that about myself, although they might say that. But you need to find somebody that knows the area of law, because I would put Rudy up at 20 years up against any 30 to 40 year attorney who doesn't, not in this practice area, and know that he would wipe the floor with them, because it would just be, there are so many nuances that people don't understand.
And I think, look, when you talk about Rusty Harden, there are those guys who can try any case. And there are plenty of attorneys who, if you present the, if I sat down and gave them the information, they could try the case and do an amazing job. I think it's that time between filing and getting it ready for trial where some of this comes into effect, as well as dealing with the courts. There's plenty of amazing trial attorneys, plenty that are much better than me, but I know a lot more about how to get us there than most.
Yeah. So Stacy, you know, Rudy, both of y'all, we filed our will contest. It's just like any other lawsuit, right? And one thing that I know we all experience with clients is their frustration at how long things take. They watch Suits or any of the other shows where the entire lawsuit's resolved in, you know, 47 minutes, not including commercials. And so then they get to this and they're like, okay, well, this is just so clear that this housekeeper or caregiver or whatever came in and did this stuff. Why is it going to take us so long to get a resolution? So, I mean, what is the timing and the process? It's just like a regular lawsuit, right? And the courts are backed up right now. There's a lot of stuff going on. So I guess talk about both of y'all's experience in that situation and how you kind of handhold the client to understanding and setting expectations.
In probate court, if you're in a statutory probate court, you're going to go to trial sooner than if you're in a district court on some contract issue. They're just much more backed up. However, as Keith mentioned, I've been doing this 24 years now, and it's a lot different than it used to be. You used to be able to get a trial in 6-7 months, something like that. I was on a scheduling conference the other day setting a trial date, and we're looking at next April, May in some of these courts. But once it's filed, you go through the discovery process, which is gathering all the documents, taking people's depositions, gathering medical records, sending discovery to the other party to find out what their evidence is. And that is a process that takes some time, is to build your case, decide what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are. And then in probate, the judge is always going to make you go to mediation before you ever get allowed to try this case. So a lot of this discovery is building up to put yourself in a strong enough position that perhaps this gets settled, which is actually a good thing most of the time, because it's very, very expensive to go to trial.
I always start my clients with the understanding that we want to generally settle the case,
yes,
right? The idea is what we're doing with discovery, because just the understanding, and I mean, you have your cases where you know they're going to go to trial because of how far apart everyone is and just certain issues. But most of the time, what I tell my clients is we're building leverage so that we can present to the other side and say, look, here's what we have, and we have a very good chance of winning. And then we try to resolve that issue. As far as length of time, I think that case where you know it's going to trial is a little easier to juggle, because you know that you can just go full bore and go through discovery and whatever it is, you know that you're setting to go to trial. But with a lot of my clients, they're not interested in spending money if they don't have to. So a lot of times there are points in the litigation where it's like, look, let's do this and then we'll do this. And there are cases that we've had together where we're like, okay, let's get this item. We just had a case recently where we agreed where we're going to go out and do all these subpoenas, and that we would work together, wait till we got them back. In that case, it may delay the trial, but it reduces the expenses, with the idea that ultimately we're all trying to build our case and present it to each other so that we can get it settled. Trying cases is fun, but it's so expensive. I mean, just incredibly expensive. If it doesn't double it, for me, I feel like it almost doubles the cost of the entire thing to go to trial, because you may have been doing all these things along, but getting ready, learning the case, having everything in order for a large litigation is a month-long process and extremely expensive, and you're spending all day on those cases.
I was going to say, you know, sometimes the client is like, well, I don't care. It's the principal. And I need to go to court and I need to have this jury tell my sister how bad she is. And you spend a lot of time talking that client down off the ledge and saying, well, that's great, but you're going to hate me at the end of the day because you will have spent more than what you get in return.
That's right.
And it's really not about the principal. It's about getting this resolved, and hopefully, and this we were going to talk a little bit about this, is the ethical challenges of will contest. But you want, sometimes, you would like the family to still have a relationship at the end of the day. Now, many times, just the fact that you filed a will contest destroys that.
But I do always have that conversation, Stacey. I'm glad you said that. The first call I ever have with a client, I make them agree with me that ultimately we're going to make a business decision.
Right.
Because if we're dealing with principle, if we're fighting about principle, then my experience is they're going to be pissed at me, because principle usually means we all lose. So I make sure they say that, and I have not taken a case, nor had anyone ever tell me they wouldn't make a business decision, although they haven't always been truthful about that. I have never had anyone not do that, but I had some experiences before I started doing that where it came down to principle, and on the other side, even if we settled in mediation, they were upset with me.
Yeah, their principles go out the window the first time they realize that their billing has gone over six figures. And as soon as they're over $100,000, they're like, well, how did we get to this place where it's all this money? It's like, and this is just a side note, but I started using Fathom and or Otter to, and have tried to have as many Zoom conferences with clients as possible, because that way it records it for posterity. But that is something that I think later on, if someone grieves you or gets angry about how expensive it is, you say, well, I'm going to go back to this recording of our original intake call. And this is where you told me you didn't care about the money. It's all about the principle. Do you recall saying that? And it's a shame. I mean, mostly the reason that I do it is because we forget things even if we're taking notes on meetings. And it's good to be able to go back and reference that stuff. But it's also something that you can use later on to remind the client, well, look, this was your attitude at the beginning. I'm sorry that it's changed now. And we understand that people's feelings evolve over time, but still, this is what you wanted to do. And so we've gone in that direction. One thing that I wanted to address with both of you is that there are litigators and then there are trial lawyers. And I think you both know what I mean by the difference. People who fancy themselves trial lawyers but aren't, we sort of put them in a box, which is they will take the case, they will do a bunch of stuff, but really they're only intending to get the case to mediation and then settle it, right? There are not as many as there used to be lawyers who are willing and able to prepare the case for trial and understand that there are not only issues with witnesses, but there's also issues with admissibility and those things that people don't consider when they're just preparing a case for mediation. But when you prepare a case to go to trial and you intend to go to trial, that actually gives you an advantage at mediation, right?
Sure. Absolutely. I'll say I've noted even outside of trial, I feel like a lot of people that I've dealt with in court, just under general evidentiary, like they don't know the rules of evidence. They don't understand objections. They don't make objections.
You're right. I mean, even when, and explaining that to a client at mediation too, they're like, well, I have this letter and see this thing, this is, but that's not admissible. Oh, but I already went and got all the medical records for mom. Well, but did you get them in admissible form? No, you didn't. You went and just gathered all of them. So now those are issues that complicate it that a lot of lawyers don't understand. I've noticed that too. Objections. I don't make as many in depositions because it doesn't really matter. But when you're in trial, you got to watch what they say and make sure that you preserve the record. And Stacy's an appellate lawyer, so it's important, right?
Yeah, it's very important. You can win a lot of things on appeal if you have a good trial lawyer. A poor trial lawyer doesn't preserve the record. So let's talk about some of these misconceptions about will contests, and then we probably need to start wrapping this up. One misconception is it's only for the wealthy, and that's not necessarily true. You have to look at a cost-benefit analysis, basically. And is it worth it? Keith and I had a long conversation with a client yesterday about diminishing returns. And we're getting to the point where I can't get you what we're spending now. So you need to look at that. But the big one I wanted to talk about, and we can all discuss this, is the no contest clauses that you find in wills, which basically says whoever contests this will takes nothing under the will. I'm involved in a case right now with a lawyer that we were just trying to get a temporary administrator appointed. And he sat there and argued for 10, 15 minutes in front of Judge Simoneau about how my client doesn't have standing anymore because she's contested the will. And I'm like, we are very much in the early stages. And I had to educate him that that's a jury question. A jury decides if it was in good faith and just cause. And that until we get there, I have standing. So have you guys ever dealt with something on a no contest clause?
I mean, I've had them come up a little bit, but I think the case law has really gone the way of giving us the idea that we shouldn't be too concerned with them as long as you have a reasonable basis for bringing it. I mean, if you go in there and you have nothing, you better get out of there as quickly as possible. And I think the statute also mentions that it's filing and maintaining. So it's kind of the idea that, look, I think filing it, you're probably pretty safe if you have a reasonable basis. And then maintaining it, I think as long as you're getting evidence that supports your side, I mean, it's a jury question, and juries can do crazy things. We all know that. But I don't think that it's a very strong, I don't think it keeps people from filing contests very often. I also really love the ones that are a no contest where they leave my client $100. So okay, what's the incentive not to contest?
Right.
It's another one that maybe we should talk about when we talk to estate planners and using that clause, because there's ways to use it that is more beneficial, and that is not a, it's meaningless in that sense.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think that historically there was a period of time, maybe prior to all three of us being licensed, where the no contest clauses were dire, very draconian. And then right around the time that all of us got licensed, they sort of shifted to the other far end of the spectrum, which was they have no effect at all, I think. And now, just like with everything, right, even politics and everything else, that you know, you go far to one extreme, far to one, and then everybody sort of settles in the middle, hopefully. At least that's what we all hope that happens. And I think now we've gotten to the point where, with no contest clauses, if there is a reasonable basis, like Rudy said, to contest the will, then it's not going to preclude you from recovering. However, if you are just doing something that has no basis in law, in fact, and doing it just to make a mess of things, or just to punish the other person to cause them to spend money or this, that, and the other, and you get to the end, then that is a situation where it might actually have some effect and be able to prevent that person from inheriting. But again, people call all the time and they say, well, there's no contest clause. I'm like, yes, but you're not a beneficiary of the will. So
what does it matter?
It doesn't matter. Or you're only left $100.
And I think that's one of, you go back to the only for the wealthy thing too. I think we should mention that under most of these scenarios now, you can get your attorney's fees paid out of the estate. So you don't necessarily have to be wealthy. I'm not generally taking clients that can't pay me as we go, because that becomes a problem. But they do have the opportunity to get their money back if they have a legitimate claim. I think if they're not promoting a will, I think they have to be successful, right?
Yes. The applicant's attorney, the statute says for the applicant of the will, it's a shall. And for the contestant, it's a may.
And I think for a contestant, if they have a will, they, even if they lose, if they say an earlier will is the proper will, if they're promoting that will, even if they lose, they can get their fees. They maybe get their fees. I think if they're contesting a will and they're looking intestacy, if they lose, I don't think they have that opportunity. I think they have to be successful, if my memory is right.
Well, I'm hoping that on a case I have right now, because they're just throwing everything, kitchen sink, everything. And I'm positive the lawyer on the other side is doing this to get his fees and just to drive it up. And so we will be contesting their fees, most definitely.
Well, I wanted to talk about one final thing really quickly, which was, we all have a responsibility to make sure that we're advising the clients properly on what the risks are associated with this. And we talked about the no contest clause and fees and things like that, but one thing that you touched on that's important is the emotional toll that it takes. Everybody's jazzed when they come into the office and they're like, oh, we're going to go get them. You're going to be my bulldog. You're going to do all this stuff. But people get litigation rash, right? Which is essentially means this has just gone on long enough and it's wearing on me. But what are some of the other emotional considerations that you guys deal with? And do you talk to the clients about that up front or in the middle or constantly? How do you deal with that?
One of the things I think we all deal with is just the devastating effects that any kind of will contest has on the family in general. Siblings, parents, whatever it is, it can ruin a family. I would say that at least half of mine that get anywhere, these people are never speaking again after it's done. We're settling, we're walking out of the mediation, they don't want to see each other, and they're never going to see each other again. When you take the steps to contest the will, there's a good chance that your family will never be the same. I'm not saying that that should dissuade everyone, but it certainly is something you have to think about. And man, it is a long, arduous process, and it will drag, and they want things to happen quickly, and they don't happen as quickly as they want. I mean, how many times have you settled where they're just like, I just want to be done. I'm tired of doing this. I'm tired of talking about it. I'm tired of worrying about it. I just want to be done. So, I mean, it's kind of like that whole idea of the mediation going till, you know, you stay in as long as it takes, because people get tired. Same thing happens in litigation in general. They get tired of doing it. When they're getting that bill every month, they get tired of the bill. So, yeah, it's a difficult situation for them to be in.
Well, and it's not just the litigants. I'm dealing with a case right now where brothers and sisters are fighting. And nieces and nephews who all got along forever and went to family gatherings and cousins, if you will, who had great relationships, and none of them are speaking anymore. They've all gone back to their camp. And they've lost that relationship because of what are the brothers and sisters, and it's gotten so ugly.
I just settled a guardianship. I know it's not a will contest, but same kind of thing. And mom, it was over mom, and my client was taking care of mom, and the two siblings were upset. There's nothing wrongdoing happened. She didn't like some of the, I guess she had given my client the house, and we unraveled everything, took everything, but they don't speak. They're not speaking again. They're not even talking to mom, who lives with my client. And so, like, there doesn't seem to be any indication that they're going to speak with mom ever again, which is crazy, but it happens.
Well, Rudy, we're very, very appreciative that you agreed to do this. And we're also very appreciative that you've now obligated yourself to part two of this, which is what estate planners can do to avoid will contests. And we will figure that out later. But all three of us have known each other for a really long time. One of the things that is really important, I know to me, and I know to both Stacy and Rudy, is that when we have cases against each other, which happens, I know that if I pick the phone up and I call Rudy and talk to him, that we can have a discussion about, okay, here is the roadmap on what we need to do to get to a resolution. I'm not calling and puffing my chest and saying, oh, I'm going to kick your butt because all this stuff. Like, there's none of that. We understand as professionals that we have a job to do, and that after the job is done, that we'll go have dinner and talk about it. And that's fine. Or laugh about it, or be on a podcast and make fun of each other about it, whatever. But it's the collegiality that we have between the people in our area that's important for us. And clients need to understand that sometimes they think, well, he knows Rudy, and so they're going to work some back deal. No. What it really means is, I know Rudy, I can call and pick up the phone, and this is likely going to save you money because we're going to be able to get to a resolution faster because there is a level of trust between us, and knowing that he's going to give me what he's supposed to give me, I'm going to give him what I'm supposed to give him, and that we're going to get to the end faster. So we appreciate your time today. And Stacy, as always, thank you for making time on a Friday. Happy Good Friday to everybody.
All right, you guys have a good one.
Now, before you go, learn more about how Stacy and Keith can help protect you by calling MK Legal or visiting us on the web. Links to our website and phone number are in the show notes. The information on this podcast is for general information purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as legal advice for any individual case or situation. This information is not intended to create, and receipt, viewing, or listening does not constitute an attorney-client relationship.